your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
The Share Institutes for Reproductive Medicine welcome you to HaveABaby.com Live with host Kim Hahn. All comments, views, and opinions are solely those of the host, guests, and callers. Kim and the doctors from the Share Institutes for Reproductive Medicine cover the questions and concerns couples face when they're trying to have a family, helping couples go from infertility to family. Here's your host, Kim Hahn.
Hi, and welcome to HaveABaby.com Live. So glad to be with you this Thursday afternoon. We have with us Dr. Bayrak, who is now the new medical director for the Share Institutes of Reproductive Medicine in Los Angeles. You might remember when we have had him on as a guest before that Dr. Bayrak was from New York, but now has taken over the Los Angeles office, so we'll get to hear a little bit about that. We're going to be talking about IVF and alternative treatment options. And really, you know, some things we're going to touch on today are, you know, what really constitutes failed treatment? Like, how many times do you need to try before, you know, it's just enough is enough and you need to do something else? We're going to talk about, you know, is it about taking a break? We're going to talk about Clomid. Is that the right treatment for all patients? So we're going to talk about a bunch of different things that, you know, might be alternatives to what you might have been, you know, done in the past and as it relates to IVF. And so I think we're going to have a great conversation. So join me in welcoming Dr. Bayrak. Hi, Dr. Bayrak.
Hello there. Hi, Kim.
Glad to have you. I am now talking to you from, you're in the West Coast now, correct?
I am, actually, yes. I'm in Los Angeles. I took over the medical directorship here. There have been some changes, and it's nice to be on the West Coast where I did some of my training. So it feels good to be here.
Are you all settled? I mean, in the office, seeing patients and your housing and
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've been here actually for the last two cycles. We are actually in our IVF cycle this week and next week. So it's busy and it's picking up. Very similar to New York.
What it means when you say you're in the middle, because when you said, I thought you were going to say like 2 months, but you're like, no, I've been here for two cycles. So, you know, for those of us that are new to, you know, the IVF terminology, what does that really mean?
It is actually 2 months in a way. A cycle, an IVF cycle, is completed generally within 2 weeks or so, and we call that the treatment cycle. However, a lot of the medications are started prior to that two-week period, such as the FSH injections, the hormone that develops the eggs, and other preparation medications such as Lupron, as well as birth control pills. So a cycle, in a way, becomes a whole month, but the more kind of intense kind of monitoring and procedures such as the egg aspiration, the egg retrieval, and the embryo transfer are done within those 2 weeks in general. So when we refer to the IVF cycle, we're really referring to the egg development as well as the retrieval of the eggs, creation of the embryos in the laboratory, and transfer of the embryos. So two cycles in a way is kind of 2 months. So it's almost the same thing.
You're putting, or when you say you're going through that, and you obviously you're seeing tons and tons of women, are you trying to get them all that, you know, on the same cycle time? Is that how that works?
It depends on when the patients are available to cycle based on their schedules. And it also depends on, obviously, when their last cycle was. And depending on the type of the treatment and the duration of the treatment, cycle times in a way change. But the majority of the patients cycle within a given a cycle date in a way, and that generally is completed within 2 weeks. Sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. Again, depending on the response, depending on the specific problem that the patient may have, depending on whether we're doing the new test that we are offering called CGH. For example, those patients who do CGH do not get a transfer right away, and their cycle is actually much shorter than a regular conventional IVF cycle. It only lasts about 6 or 7 days. after starting the after coming in for their first ultrasound. So
okay.
It all depends on the specific type of cycle and problem involved in each case.
Okay, so well, congratulations for
Thank
being in
much.
Los Angeles, and I'm sure the patients out there are very lucky to have you.
Thanks. That's good to hear.
Yeah, and okay, so today we want to talk about, you know, IVF and alternative treatments. And I guess, you know, we know that IVF is a costly, you know, prospect for a lot of people. And if it doesn't work, I mean, I'm going to kind of jump into this and then we'll kind of work our way
sure.
into other topics. But I guess to get to the bottom line of some of this is if it doesn't work, really, how many times do you consider it, you know, a failure and you need to do something else?
That's a great question, and this is a very common question that a lot of patients ask us on a regular basis. A failed IVF cycle, in a way, can be just following the initial attempt. It can be just following a single cycle. Obviously, that's an attempt, and that would be, in a way, quote-unquote, called a failed cycle.
One quick question. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm just thinking, is a failed cycle the same as a canceled cycle as well, or is canceled not considered a failure?
I mean, I think if you are not pregnant and if you don't carry that pregnancy to term and end up with a healthy baby, that would still be considered a failed cycle. At least that's how I look at it.
Okay, so if somebody started on treatment and let's say
right.
they hyperstimulated and you couldn't go forward.
Yeah, that's a different situation, right?
Okay.
I think we're kind of talking about terminology here. But
okay.
Failed cycle overall, I think, is referred to as a cycle that is completed.
Okay.
And egg retrieval is done and embryo transfer is performed, but the pregnancy test is negative.
Okay.
I think overall, more commonly, that's the failed cycle. But if, let's say, the woman goes through the cycle and she starts stimulating, but she has absolutely no response, let's say she is not able to develop any eggs, and obviously in that case, that would be a canceled cycle, but at the same time, that would be a failed IVF cycle, even though she did not complete the full course of treatment. Or something that you just referred a little bit earlier, hyperstimulation, for example. In some cases, if there is overstimulation of the ovaries where the ovaries just develop so many eggs that we believe it's going to be risky to transfer the embryos in that fresh particular cycle, then we tend to freeze the embryos and allow
okay, so
the hyperstimulation to resolve. So I don't think that's a failed cycle,
okay.
But that's just a canceled cycle in a way. And the cancellation is just a transfer, but not the whole cycle in itself. So I wouldn't call that a failed cycle. That's in a way overstimulation or just too good of a cycle that we had so many eggs that we couldn't even transfer because of certain risks.
Yeah, and that's so if someone does overstimulate, it's not a problem with the eggs that are the problem. It's a problem with the transfer.
Right, and it really comes down to the assessment of the patient, and this can be individualized, obviously. The thinking is that if you are pregnant following a hyperstimulated cycle, hyperstimulation and its symptoms take a little bit longer period of time to resolve, as opposed to going through the hyperstimulation, retrieving the eggs, and not doing the transfer. So hyperstimulation syndrome resolves much sooner if the patient is not pregnant. And we believe that this is due to the pregnancy hormone stimulating or aggravating and making the situation a little bit worse.
Okay.
So that's really truly the reason to freeze the embryos, and not do the transfer, and in return hope that hyperstimulation is going to resolve much sooner.
Okay, so all is not lost then if you hyperstimulate.
Not at all, actually. Most of the time, those patients will get pregnant in a subsequent, what we call frozen embryo transfer cycle, where they don't have to stimulate their ovaries. They just need to prepare their uterine lining, and we thaw the embryos and simply just transfer them back into the uterus. And if a patient hyperstimulates, that means that the ovaries are so healthy and they have so many eggs that with a little bit of medicine, they just develop so many eggs that we consider them to be hyperstimulated or overstimulated. So
okay.
Those patients generally actually have a baby in the subsequent cycle, but not in that what we call the fresh cycle.
All right, getting back to the original question, sorry that
sure.
I had so many in between.
No problem.
We were talking about, how many failures are too many, and you were saying, and you were just getting into that.
Yeah, again, that's a relative concept there. It all depends on the characteristics of the patient and what the cause of the infertility was to start with. As some of our listeners may know, IVF success rates are dependent on many variables. But in today's world, most of the time they're dependent on the woman's age. So the age really truly determines the success rate or the outcome of the IVF cycle. So, for example, if you look at the national statistics or our statistics in a way, any patient age less than 35, for example, without any significant variables, without any significant problems, such as a significant, let's say, ovarian compromise in terms of the egg reserve. The pregnancy rates are approximately about 45 to 50%. So with one attempt in best hands and in the best IVF laboratories, the chances are about approximately 50%. So that's like flipping the coin.
Right.
So let's say there is a 30-year-old patient, a couple, who has otherwise no clear problems in their infertility. And let's say they did other treatment options in the past, and now they're doing IVF, their chances are about 50% of getting pregnant and holding on to that pregnancy. So if they try once, and if they fail, and they say, you know what, we failed, so we should probably just stop trying and not do it again, obviously that will not be the right thing to do because their chances at best are about 50%. So if they try the next time, and there's obviously a statistical calculation for that, which is based on the cumulative pregnancy rate, it kind of adds up in a way with additional tries, there's another 50% chance approximately in their second attempt. So the way that it's calculated is that if you have 100 couples doing IVF, 50 of them are going to have a baby in 9 months after the first IVF cycle. The rest of the 50 couples are obviously unhappy and they're going to say, you know what, we had a failed IVF cycle, which is obviously correct, right? If they try again, another 50% of the remaining 50 couples, which is about approximately 25, right,
mm-hmm.
will get pregnant. So at the end of two fresh cycles, 75 couples will get pregnant, or 75% pregnancy rate will be achieved.
Okay,
again,
these
are approximate numbers. It's just for understanding it. We're
right.
kind of rounding it up. But that's basically the core in terms of understanding what the statistics are, what the chances are, and what we can call a failed IVF cycle. Let's
okay.
say a couple well, tries multiple times in the same situation. Let's say they did four IVF cycles with a 50% chance. Then I think that would truly be, in a way, multiple failures because that couple would have a very high chance of success. But at the same time, despite multiple attempts, there may be something else going on that resulted in the negative outcome.
Okay.
So in those cases, I think we can truly say, you know what, we really had the multiple failed IVF cycles, and now we need to look at some alternatives.
All right, let's take a quick break because we're out of time for the first break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Byrock, who's the medical director for the Share Institutes of Reproductive Medicine in Los Angeles. You're listening to HaveABaby.com Live, and we'll be right back.
Opinions, options, answers. Voice America Health and Wellness.
When you're dealing with infertility, you want answers and you want them as fast as possible. Did you know there was a place you could go to communicate directly with more than a dozen infertility specialists free of charge? If you're looking for answers to your infertility questions, visit the discussion boards at haveababy.com. You can post your questions on any infertility-related topic to physicians around the country and communicate with other people who are going through the same experiences as you are. Because the boards at haveababy.com are monitored directly by physicians, you'll usually get a response within a few hours. Registration is free and only takes a minute. For answers to all of your infertility questions, log on to the discussion boards at haveababy.com. You'll have access to hundreds of pages of information and be able to communicate directly with more than a dozen infertility specialists. haveababy.com, your online infertility resource.
Conceive Magazine is America's first magazine about making babies. In the pages of Conceive, we inspire and inform future moms with comprehensive information about women's health and fertility, as well as various methods of conception. Conceive Magazine offers comfort and emotional support to women contemplating starting or expanding their families by consulting noted professional experts and by sharing the insights and experiences of others who have already begun the journey. In every issue, you'll find the latest news in conception, fertility, and the newest products on the market. Well-balanced information on exercise, nutrition, and healthy lifestyle tips to help you prepare for pregnancy. Real-life success stories from women who have achieved their dream of parenthood, and so much more. To subscribe to Conceive Magazine or to get more information, go to our website, conceiveonline.com, or call us toll-free at 1-800-758-0770. Conceive Magazine, a must-have resource for women beginning one of life's most important journeys.
A fresh look at today's health. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to HaveABaby.com Live with host Kim Hahn. If you have a question or comment, call us toll-free at 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Kim.
Hi, and welcome back to HaveABaby.com Live. We're talking today with Dr. Bayrock, who is the medical director for the Share Institutes of Reproductive Medicine in Orlando, who has come from New York, where he was the attending physician at the New York office. Welcome back, Dr. Bayrock.
Hello there.
Okay, you did a really good job of explaining the math to us in the first segment. And then you talk about alternatives. And I was wondering if in this segment we can talk about what are some of those alternatives for that last couple that you just got done describing.
Sure. I mean, obviously, it all depends on the individual case. And depending on what the response was with the failed IVF cycles. For example, let's take a couple who has no identifiable cause of infertility, and they produce a good number of embryos and eggs, but for some reason they're not able to get pregnant. That case would be a little bit different from another couple who has done multiple IVF cycles but did not get that many eggs and had some kind of an ovarian compromise.
Okay, well, the first couple maybe. Let's start with them.
Right. So when we compare the two couples, the first couple may take a different direction, such as advanced testing for other causes that may have resulted in the failed IVF cycle, such as immunological disorders or increased natural killer cells in the uterus, some type of an immunological mismatch between the couples, or a chromosomal abnormality in each embryo that we were not able to detect just by the visual inspection of the embryos under the microscope. In those cases, not additional testing is only necessary, but also our newest technology, for example, called CGH, would identify whether it is really indeed a problem with the embryo that resulted in the failed IVF cycles, or it is really related to the uterus or some kind of an immunological disorder that resulted in the failed IVF cycles. So after some point where there are a number of IVF attempts and it results in failures, or no pregnancies or miscarriages, whatever the cause may be, or the consequence following that IVF attempt, it will be very important to further identify any unusual type of problems that could have been that could not have been picked up in the initial diagnostic procedure. So these are advanced tests, and some of which may not be conventional in a way, and there are some treatments for those abnormalities that we can further discuss. Now, in the second couple, who has done, let's say, multiple IVF cycles, but they did not have a good response. Let's say we did not get good eggs, good number of eggs, and we are suspecting that there is some type of an ovarian reserve compromise. So the number of eggs in the ovaries has declined to a point where there are no symptoms, no identifiable really true cause of infertility otherwise, and despite multiple IVF attempts, we did not get that many eggs, and we did not get good quality embryos.
Okay.
Now, that is a totally different type of situation where that is, again, failed IVF cycle, but the direction would be to consider other options, other treatment options, such as donor eggs. So in those cases, if the problem is, for example, the egg quality, which refers to the chromosome abnormality of the egg, which again results in the chromosome abnormality of the embryo, then in those cases, we'll have to really treat the actual cause, which would be improving the egg quality. There are some things that we can do in terms of protocols, but still we're limited to what we can develop in the ovaries. And if it comes to a point where a patient does 3, 4, 5, 6 IVF cycles and really we don't get anywhere, and each time the response is going down, let's say in the initial cycle we had 10 eggs, and the second one we had 8, and the last one we had 5, and the last cycle, fifth, sixth cycle, now we have 2 or 3 eggs, that means obviously there's a declining ovarian reserve. So in those cases, in those kind of failed IVF cycles, alternative treatments such as the use of donor eggs becomes very helpful. So it truly depends on what constitutes a failed IVF cycle and what really caused that failed IVF cycle, so that we can direct our next step and the next treatment option based on what the patient's history was and also what the response was during the IVF cycles. And even though IVF is therapeutic or treatment, it is active treatment, obviously, there's no doubt about that. When we look behind, when we look backwards after a failed IVF cycle, it also becomes diagnostic.
Right.
So we can actually assess what the ovaries reserve of the ovaries was, and also how many eggs we could get based on what type of protocol we used. We'll know about the fertilization. We'll know about the embryo quality and some of the characteristics during embryo development in culture. So even though IVF is therapeutic, it becomes quite diagnostic when we go back and analyze the data we have from the laboratory following the failed IVF cycle.
Okay, so you gave us two really good examples of you know, two different couples that might have to take a different path. And, you know, I guess at some point, and I might have asked this question to some of the other physicians as well, is there a limit on how many IVFs you would, you know, allow a couple to go through? Or, you know, is this pretty much kind of negotiated step by step?
Yeah, I don't think there's any set number, and there's no set limit. I think overall, after 2 or 3 failed IVF cycles, one has to think about the true cause of the failed IVF cycle. And again, it depends on the specifics, as we discussed in the two examples that I presented. It can be, in most cases, either the embryo or the uterus itself or some kind of an immunological problem that's resulting in the failed IVF cycle. And if it is indeed the a uterus or some kind of immunological disorder, then it would be reasonable to continue with a similar type of approach and not give up, because there's still going to be hope, but there may be some changes in the protocol or some additional medications or additional testing required. So there's really no set number. It's not 3, it's not 6, not 10. Obviously, more attempts we do, higher the chances. And that's really what it comes down to. Also, it is related truly to the success rates in each particular case. We talked about the best case scenario, which is a younger couple who had no identifiable cause of infertility, at least in the beginning, until they have undergone IVF treatment, and that will be about 50%. If you look at the population above the age of 40, for example, the full-term pregnancy rates, or what we call delivery rates, or live birth rates, are in the range of about 20 to 30%. So if we have, let's say, again, 100 couples about the age of 40 or 42, for example, their chances are about 20 or 30% each time they try, and it adds up. So
right.
After the first cycle, for example, if you have 100 couples, only 20 of them are going to get pregnant. And in the second cycle, out of the 80, again, 20% of that remaining 80 will get pregnant. Again, we're talking about approximate numbers.
Right.
So that's another 16 patients, for example. So after two cycles, only about 36% pregnancy rate can be accomplished. In a subsequent cycle, there's about roughly, let's say, 74 patients remaining. Again, another, let's say, 20, 30%. That's another 14, 15 patients, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
So after about three IVF cycles in the group of patients between about 40 to 42, after about three IVF cycles, we're able to reach a 50% pregnancy rate. This would be the pregnancy rate in following a single IVF cycle in women less than about age 35. So it also depends on what the success rates are, what the cause of the infertility is, and knowing the statistics and the chances. So if, let's say, we have a couple who is 42 and they have done two IVF cycles and they are trying to understand why they had the failed IVF cycle, well, the chances of failing actually after one or two IVF cycles is much greater than having a successful outcome. Again, based on the statistics, based on the fact that we are not going to get normal embryos in each cycle, and that's why it takes multiple tries. So in those cases where the success rates are not very high, but they're reasonable to continue, it is recommended that they continue more. But again, it obviously comes down to a number of other variables, such as the financial aspect of this. If there's no insurance coverage, if the couple cannot afford IVF, obviously that may be a reason to continue treatment.
Right, exactly. And the emotional piece as well.
Absolutely.
How much they can
financially,
handle.
Emotionally, stress involved. Yep,
right.
Those are all the variables involved in each case. So other than the medical indications and decisions, obviously there's another component to this, which is the emotional part, the stress, and how many times do you have to try to become pregnant. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of understanding, but more importantly, I think it is very important to educate the patients so that they exactly know what the chances are and what the possibilities are following the IVF cycle.
And I guess one other question that might be running through people's minds right now is, you know, obviously you said there really isn't a limit, but do women have to consider the amount of, you know, drugs and injections that they're putting into their body? Is there any standard on that, or has, you know, there been no, we haven't really found any detriment to, you know, taking all the hormones and injections?
On the short run, it doesn't appear to be harmful. On the long run, again, it doesn't appear to be harmful either. There's some mixed information in the medical literature whether these drugs are going to increase in a risk of cancer or other abnormalities on the long run. There are a number of studies that did not show that it actually does indeed. So there's a little bit of controversy on that, but we believe that they don't. It really comes down to going through the procedures. Obviously, whenever we do a medical procedure, there's always a risk. Although with IVF, the risks are relatively low with egg retrievals and embryo transfers, but still, it is a procedure. And again, there's the emotional toll to this and also financial.
Exactly.
To mention that, yeah.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to continue talking with Dr. Bayrek, who's the medical director for the Share Institutes of Reproductive Medicine in Los Angeles. And if you want to get more information about what we're talking about today, you can go to haveababy.com, and we will be right back after the break.
A healthy dialogue for your lifestyle. Voice America Health and Wellness.
Have you been searching for an online resource that brings together all of the most current and vital information on infertility causes, diagnosis, and treatment? Welcome to HaveABaby.com, your online infertility resource. Here, you'll find hundreds of pages of articles on topics related to infertility, plus a forum where you can post your questions to infertility experts around the country. But that's not all. HaveABaby.com features profiles of infertility specialists, news, and upcoming events related to infertility, as well as stories from other people that have been through or are going through infertility. HaveABaby.com is a community centered around people just like you. Log on today for exciting information on your latest infertility breakthroughs, including a new procedure that could double your chances of having a baby through IVF. Or visit the discussion boards and post your questions for infertility experts around the country. HaveABaby.com, your online infertility resource.
Conceive Magazine is America's first magazine about making babies. In the pages of Conceive, we inspire and inform future moms with comprehensive information about women's health and fertility, as well as various methods of conception. Conceive Magazine offers comfort and emotional support to women contemplating starting or expanding their families by consulting noted professional experts and by sharing the insights and experiences of others who have already begun the journey. In every issue, you'll find the latest news in conception, fertility, and the newest products on the market. Well-balanced information on exercise, nutrition, and healthy lifestyle tips to help you prepare for pregnancy. Real-life success stories from women who have achieved their dream of parenthood, and so much more. To subscribe to Conceive Magazine or to get more information, go to our website, conceiveonline.com, or call us toll-free at 1-800-758-0770. Conceive Magazine, a must-have resource for women beginning one of life's most important journeys.
Steps to a Healthier You. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to HaveABaby.com Live with host Kim Hahn. If you have a question or comment, call us toll-free at 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Kim.
Talking about, you know, what is failure when it comes to fertility treatments, and when is it time to consider different alternatives? And we're here with Dr. Bayrek, who is the medical director for the Share Institutes in Los Angeles. And I have to say, Dr. Bayrek, first of all, welcome back.
Thank you.
Also, I don't know that I've ever heard the math, and I'm a math person, so explained the way that you explained it. And I know, at least for myself, and I'm hoping for our listeners, that, that really put a lot of perspective around, what's considered success rates and how they kind of work. So I think that explanation was really, really good.
I think that's very important in explaining, even before the IVF cycle, what the chances are and also how the numbers work, because there's absolutely no doubt that a failed IVF cycle will bring a lot of stress, frustration, and mixed emotions about whether to continue treatment or not, because it is not unusual for couples to go into an IVF cycle that it's just going to happen 100%. And even though IVF is in a way, the best treatment, regardless of age, regardless of the etiology or the cause of the infertility, still it is not 100%.
Right.
And per cycle, at best, it's about 50%, unless a couple is doing CGH testing, which is the newest technology that we're offering. In those cases, obviously, we're identifying the chromosomally normal embryos, or the best embryos, or the best quality embryos, and then we transfer those embryos back in. Then we accomplish a pregnancy rate of about 65 to 70%. But that's different. And we have to find the chromosomally normal embryos, obviously. And because we're not correcting the problem, we're really identifying it. In some couples, we don't find any chromosomally normal embryos. And in those cases, again, that will result in a failed IVF cycle. So it all comes down to understanding the numbers, chances, and how many IVF cycles it may take for a couple to become pregnant and secure that pregnancy term.
Well, that's that leads me to a question, though, about CGH, because if, you know, and obviously if you don't find any normal embryos, that's considered failed right there. So that's going to affect the numbers. But if you were to find a good embryo that's genetically solid, and you were to place that in, what would the chance be at that point if you took out all the people that couldn't come up with one, you know, good embryo?
All right. I mean, based on our research, which we published and we're continuing to publish as we have increasing numbers, a lot of our patients are now interested in doing CGH. And the benefit is, in a way, exponential, if that's the right term, because we know now that, based on our evidence, it truly comes down to the embryo and whether that embryo is normal or abnormal in reaching our goal of a successful pregnancy. If the embryo is chromosomally or genetically abnormal, that will either result in no pregnancy, or in a way, a failed IVF cycle, or a miscarriage in the first 3 months, or in the second 3 months, or what we call a fetal demise in the second trimester, or a full-term pregnancy and a fetus with birth defects. So if you look at the majority of the IVF cycles that have failed, they are due to a chromosomal abnormality of the embryo. If you look at majority of the miscarriages, they are indeed due to a chromosomal abnormality of the embryo. And the same thing with the birth defects. So adding everything together, when we identify a chromosomally normal embryo, number one, that's not only going to result in implantation and the clinical healthy pregnancy, but also the risk of miscarriage is going to be lower. Again, because we're putting back a chromosomally normal embryo into the uterus.
Right.
So automatically it's going to decrease the risk. So the benefit is exponential in those cases. But again, it all comes down to finding that chromosomally normal embryo, because if the embryo is abnormal chromosomally, we are not correcting the problem. We're identifying it. But once we identify it and find it, then the pregnancy rates are exponentially high, and also the risk of miscarriage is low, and also potentially the birth defects should be also lower, because we're not putting back any chromosomally normal abnormal embryos. So in those particular cases, again, regardless of age, as long as we can find one or two good embryos, the pregnancy rates are very high. So in that kind of a situation, obviously the statistics are going to be different. So if our pregnancy rates are 60 or 70%, after transfer of, let's say, two chromosomally normal, or what we call CGH normal embryos, then the exponential pregnancy rates are going to be accomplished. Let's say we have 100 couples, they're all doing CGH, and let's be conservative, let's say only about 60 or 65% of the time they get pregnant. After one cycle, 65 couples are going to get pregnant. In a subsequent cycle, out of the 35 remaining couples, again, 65% of the remaining 35 is going to get pregnant. That's almost another 15, 20 pregnancies.
Right.
So you're almost up to about 80, 85%. And if there are still couples who are not pregnant, which is, should be not more than 10 or 15, again, it's almost another 65%. So you're almost up to 99.5%.
After three.
That's exactly right. But the catch is that you should be able to find the chromosomally normal embryos. And if you do, it's going to happen. Unless there are some unusual abnormalities, such as an immunological mismatch. Let's say a patient has multiple fibroids in her uterus, or she had multiple surgeries from her uterus, or the endometrial cavity is deformed, or some other medical disorders. And these are, again, not very common. But in those circumstances, this pregnancy may not be a healthy one, even though we're transferring a chromosomally normal embryo.
Okay.
So that becomes very helpful in understanding what the chances are when we do CGH. However, we have to find chromosome normal embryos, because if you don't have a chromosome normal embryo, then we don't have anything.
Right, which is amazing. And so once you can identify that, you know that you can basically identify any of the other issues for the most part, whether it be with the uterine cavity or the immunological issues and so on and so forth, correct?
That's correct. And patients can be screened for those, obviously, before the embryo transfer, which is actually what we're doing. Obviously, we're not going to put back a totally normal, chromosomally normal, precious embryo into a uterus where we did not test, or where there are multiple fibroids, or where there is some kind of a abnormal immunological activity, for example. Immunological testing, obviously, is not routine. We don't do it on everybody. However, if there's a significant history, if there's nothing identifiable otherwise, then those patients may benefit from that kind of a testing. And in some cases, let's say a couple has multiple failed IVF cycles, they have five IVF cycles that are failed, and they have a lot of embryos, then we think about another reason, but another reason other than the embryos being the cause, and we would like to control for the most important variable, which is the chromosome structure of the embryo. So those patients tend to do CGH, and we eliminate all the abnormal embryos, and now the only thing that we have to deal with is the uterus.
And that's great, and I was glad to hear you say that, because I was thinking if I had tested and I had found an embryo that was, you know, 100% genetically, you know, a good embryo, I would hope that, like you said, that you would have tested everything else, because you don't want to take that little bit of chance since you've, you know, already found a really good one.
That's correct. The major variable, obviously, is the embryo. And for years and years, we really did not know whether it was the embryo or the uterus. And we always assumed that, you know, it's probably the embryo that's chromosomally abnormal. And the majority of the medical studies are done based on that assumption. And when you have a major variable in a disease or in an abnormality, and if you don't control for that, you can't really study other abnormalities. Let's say we're studying pregnancy outcome, and the major variable is the embryo chromosome structure. If we are not controlling for that, then we can't really understand what's going on with the uterus or other variables. We can't even test specific treatments because we still don't know about the major variable, which is indeed the embryo. So now we have this great tool where we can identify what the cause of the infertility is in a way.
Right.
Because oftentimes I have patients in my office and they've done two or three failed IVF cycles and they failed. And they say, you know what, we really don't know what's going on. How can we find out? And somebody told us that maybe it's the embryo, maybe it's the uterus. Well, now we have an answer because now we can identify the normal embryos.
Right.
So it just becomes a great tool to use in the...
I know, I agree. The CGH is, you know, is going to change so much for so many people going forward.
Absolutely. It already has, actually, and it's just growing.
And it's just starting, so...
Right.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. I do want to... I know we're going to talk more a little bit about the immunological issues in our last segment and some of the other things that could affect it, but I want to ask you when we come back about blood type and if that plays a part into the embryo as well. You're listening to HaveABaby.com Live. You can go to www.haveababy.com and get more information about what we're talking about. We're here with Dr. Byrock, and we are going to be right back after the break.
You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
The Share Institutes for Reproductive Medicine are proud to sponsor HaveABaby.com Live. With 10 centers, 5 satellite offices, and 15 outstanding physicians throughout the country, the Share Institutes make up one of the nation's largest networks of IVF practices. The Share Institutes have roots that run deep in the field of infertility treatment. Founder Dr. Jeffrey Share established the first private IVF practice in the country in 1982 and has been an influential pioneer in the field for 25 years. The Share Institutes are renowned for compassionate, personalized fertility care backed by leading-edge technology and ongoing medical breakthroughs. The Share Institutes for Reproductive Medicine website, HaveABaby.com, is one of the most comprehensive infertility resources on the web today. Log on to HaveABaby.com for more information on the Share Institute's reproductive medicine. HaveABaby.com, your online infertility resource.
Conceive Magazine is America's first magazine about making babies. In the pages of Conceive, we inspire and inform future moms with comprehensive information about women's health and fertility, as well as various methods of conception. Conceive Magazine offers comfort and emotional support to women contemplating starting or expanding their families by consulting noted professional experts and by sharing the insights and experiences of others who have already begun the journey. In every issue, you'll find the latest news in conception, fertility, and the newest products on the market. Well-balanced information on exercise, nutrition, and healthy lifestyle tips to help you prepare for pregnancy. Real-life success stories from women who have achieved their dream of parenthood, and so much more. To subscribe to Conceive Magazine or to get more information, go to our website, conceiveonline.com, or call us toll-free at 1-800-758-0770. Conceive Magazine, a must-have resource for women beginning one of life's most important journeys.
Step into a healthier you. Voice America Health and Wellness.
You're listening to HaveABaby.com Live with host Kim Hahn. If you have a question or comment, call us toll-free at 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. Now back to the show. Here's Kim.
Hi, and welcome back. We're talking today about IVF and alternative treatment options when IVF doesn't work. We're here with Dr. Byrock. Hi, Dr. Byrock. Welcome back.
Hello, Kim. Thanks.
Okay, so I love it. I feel like I've really taken away this whole understanding of the statistics of, you know, these treatments, which really can help you get a whole different perspective around it. Having been somebody who's gone through three IVFs, I get it more now, and I wish I kind of understood the math because, you know, I just wanted, like you said, after the first one, you want to give up. It is really helpful to hear that. But I want to talk to you a little bit about blood type. You know, does blood type matter when you're trying to get pregnant of, you know, the woman and the man? Does it ever affect fertility or pregnancy?
In most parts, no. It doesn't really. We don't think that it causes infertility or affects infertility or fertility in any adverse way. Blood type is obviously very important, and it really comes down to the Rh type, being Rh positive or negative matters. And if the mother is Rh negative, and if the father is Rh positive, then there can be some incompatibility issues there. But otherwise, it does not affect fertility for the most part.
And what about miscarriage? If, you know, if certain blood types get together, is there a higher risk for miscarriage that couples should test blood type?
Well, we do test the blood type, actually, at our center routinely on all couples. We do screen for antibodies in the blood. That's a standard kind of workup for us to understand whether there was some type of immunization in the past and whether the female partner is Rh negative or not.
Okay.
If the female partner is Rh positive, then there should be minimal concern about blood incompatibility.
So you are testing that, and most women could, if they are going to a fertility clinic doing IVF, can expect that this is being looked out for?
That's certainly a pretty standard test, and also it's done as a part of the prenatal workup.
Okay.
So during pregnancy, it is almost routine to get the blood type and the screen. And screen refers to the antibodies that may be present in the blood. Again, that may be due to a prior immunization.
Okay.
So a prior immunization means, in a way, getting vaccinated.
Right.
But this is, again, being immunized or vaccinated in a bad way, because if the antibodies are formed, that may affect future pregnancies. So those antibodies may actually attack the fetus and, more importantly, the blood cells, and result in anemia, low blood count in the developing fetus, and that can result in second and third trimester complications or fetal death. And if it's really advanced, it can also result in miscarriages. But it has to be really advanced to get to that point.
Okay.
So I would say overall, rarely it would cause fertility problems.
Okay, so that's not something that we need to consider. But you've mentioned some of the other things, like such as killer cells and some immunological. Are killer cells the same thing as having hostile mucus?
Similar, although not the same thing.
Okay.
Hostile mucus refers to a cervical mucus that increases with the increasing estrogen level during the egg development phase in the early part of the cycle, and the poor interaction of the sperm with the cervical mucus, again, may result in the prevention of the sperm from reaching the egg in the fallopian tube. It used to be a routine test in the past to look at the interaction between the sperm and the mucus. We don't do that anymore. It really does not predict anything at all. It doesn't change our management, so it's really not a useful test. It used to be called a postcoital test.
Mm-hmm.
So that would give you information about the cervical mucus and its interaction with the sperm. Again, that is a historical test these days. We don't do that anymore. And the natural killer cells, I think you were referring to earlier, is quite different from the cervical mucus, or the hostile cervical mucus, in a way that natural killer cells are cells that are present in everybody, in a way, and they kind of protect us from foreign antigens, foreign antibodies, in a way, or any kind of an abnormal cell in the body, such as a tumor cell that may form, would be controlled by these natural killer cells. They would identify the abnormality that is different from the DNA that we all have in our bodies, specific to us, and it would identify those abnormal antigens or antibodies or anything that is different and control that. Now, the implanting embryo obviously contains genes from the mother and the father, and it is genetically different. And every embryo is different from the DNA of the male and the female partners. So in that case, the antigenic environment that the uterus is in is going to be a little bit different from the implanting embryo. And during the early stages of implantation, there's a tolerance by the uterus, by the mother, to the implanting embryo, so that the embryo can implant even though it is different in its genetic makeup. So in some cases, these natural killer cells that are present everywhere in the body, but they kind of concentrate in the uterine cavity, in the endometrial cavity, at the time of implantation, and we believe that they control implantation. Again, there is limited information on the activity of natural killer cells and what really exactly they do at the time of implantation. But the thinking behind the testing for the natural killer cell activity is that are these white cells or differentiated white cells increased in numbers and their activity, and whether that's causing miscarriages or infertility. So
okay.
That's really truly the reason to test the natural killer cells. But again, it's not a routine test. It's not still a well-established test, in a way. I think we're going to need further studies to prove that it truly makes a difference to test everybody prior to their treatment. But I think we're not there yet.
Not there yet.
So in specific situations where, again, there are no other identifiable causes, or let's
say
this is
one of the tests,
endometriosis or another disease that would increase their risk, then we would do the testing.
Okay, and just one question, though. When we were talking about the cervical mucus, and you said you don't really do the postcoital test anymore, then what? How would you know that the sperm wasn't getting where it needed to go? Like, how would a couple know not to keep trying and trying and trying? Is there, can it get past at that point, or is it just you jump straight to artificial insemination if you're not getting pregnant?
Right.
Or
IUI. That's a good question and a very common question. Yeah, we directly go to IUI in those cases. In cases where the postcoital test is normal or abnormal, pregnancy rates are actually the same. So it really doesn't add any additional information. It doesn't change our management. So that's really the reason why we don't do it anymore.
Okay, so basically then you just kind of jump to IUI.
Or continue time intercourse, for example, because, again, if they try on their own, with or without a bad cervical mucus or a hostile cervical mucus, if you will, again, that doesn't change anything, the fact that it's hostile or not.
Really?
So that is really not a good test, and that's why we abandoned it. We're not doing it anymore.
Okay, great. Well, we are just about out of time. This has been a great conversation. As always, we could probably go for another hour, so I'm sure you'll be back with us. So thank you, Dr. Bayrock, for being here.
Thank you very much for having me on the show, Kim.
It was great. I know it's a busy time, so thank you very much for taking the time out. I want to let everybody know as well, we want to thank the Share Institutes for Reproductive Medicine for helping families go from helping couples go from infertility to family. Again, we'll be back next week with another great show. You've been listening to HaveABaby.com Live. If you want more information, go to www.haveababy.com. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
The Share Institutes for Reproductive Medicine thanks you for listening to HaveABaby.com Live. For more information, visit HaveABaby.com. Tune in next Thursday for another insightful hour on HaveABaby.com Live with host Kim Hahn.